హరే కృష్ణ. ఐ హవ్ బీన్ రిక్వెస్టెడ్ బై ది డివోటీస్ హు ఆర్ సో డియర్లీ వర్షిప్డ్ విత్ ఇన్ మై హార్ట్ టు స్పీక్ ఎ మెసేజ్ concerning the life of one of the greatest Vaishnavas of the modern world, His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. By His loving friendship, kindness, and mercy, He requested me to remain with him for the last 7.5 weeks of his life on this earth. It was truly amazing. For the weeks that he was in his final stages, tens and thousands of people through internet and other sources were several times a day connecting to hear the reports about his life and his condition. Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj deeply affected people's lives with the impact of awakening a genuine and real yearning for Krishna consciousness. I entitled today's lecture, A Life of Compassion, Dedication, and Love, His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. Yesterday, we celebrated the disappearance day of the Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur. We learned how Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he broadcast the most important message of this age of Kali, Harinam Sankirtan, the Yuga Dharma, through a person who was born in an outcast, untouchable family by social standards. A person who came from a background which was rejected and suppressed by the Hindu society. But yet Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu claimed that he was the crown jewel of the entire universe. When Haridas Thakur passed from this world, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in ecstatic love, held the body of Haridas in his lap and danced in ecstasy. Personally bathed the body of Haridas Thakur, personally buried the body of Haridas Thakur. Lord Chaitanya personally begged from the common people to conduct a feast for Haridas Thakur and glorified him if he had 5 mouths. Yes. This is the Lord's message to the world. That even those persons who are socially in a very depressed or rejected state can elevate themselves to the highest ultimate perfection and be fit to be spiritual masters of the whole universe if they sincerely take to the process of bhakti and the chanting of the holy names. I'd like to speak something about the background of Bhakti Tirtha Maharaja's race so that we can get an understanding, a better appreciation of his greatness, where he was coming from and what he became. People are interested in hearing stories of rags to riches, success stories of people with nothing who come to the top of their particular fields. We will find this in a most resplendent form in the life of Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. Srila Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj ki jai. He's coming from the African-American race. In America, the African people for centuries were oppressed and persecuted. The first Africans came to America in 1619 when a slave trader from Holland came to the West Indies, and he ran out of food, and he traded about a dozen African people as slaves in exchange for food. And soon this became very popular. At that time, in the colonies of America, one of the best profit-making crops was tobacco, and they needed a lot of workers in the fields. So they were importing Africans from America, to America as slaves. The history is long. It's a fascinating subject. Perhaps the greatest, most obvious sign of hypocrisy of the United States of America. The country was founded on the principle that all men are created equal. These innocent African people, their villages were raided. They were torn out of their homes, put in concentration camps, forcibly, not paid anything, just literally kidnapped, held as prisoners, put on overcrowded boats, shipped across an ocean, and then sold as slaves. According to statistics, between 12 and 20 million Africans were forcibly ripped out of their homes and sent to America to be slaves between 1619 and 1867. 5% died in the prison camps in Africa. Over 15% died due to overcrowded, inhumane conditions on the boats. And 30% died within the first 3 months of being in America due to inhuman conditions in which they were treated. So approximately 50% died before they were even made into slaves. Whipping, in order to prove who the owner was, they would brand them sometimes on the face with hot iron. They weren't allowed to have their own name. They were given the name of their masters. They had no legal rights whatsoever. They were treated worse than animals. This went on for over 200 years. And then in 1861, America had a civil war. It began in 1861, it ended in 1865. One of the prime reasons for this war is the North wanted to abolish slavery and the South wanted to keep slavery. 3 million men fought in this war. 600,000 Americans were killed. More than World War I, more than World War II, more than any other war, Americans were killing each other. And ultimately, with the victory of the North, in 1865, the 13th Amendment of the Constitution was created, which abolished slavery. Previously, in 1667, slavery became a legal institution throughout America. After 200 years, they finally came to the point of freeing the slaves. But in many cases, this was only an external, superficial, legalistic reality. Because the people, the African American people, were so downtrodden, and they were looked upon as such inferior beings by the white people, that practically all of them were forced to live in the poverty of ghettos. Little food, little sanitation. They were not given the rights to have proper education. Therefore, practically the only jobs they could get, if any, was just hard labor. Especially in the southern states, blacks were not allowed to use the same restrooms as whites. They were not allowed to use the same drinking fountain. They had to go to the back of the buses, and they were never allowed in the same schools. Inferior education. Keep them down. And if they tried to get some rights, they would usually be beaten, tortured, or killed. And factually, this was the way America was until the 1960s. Dr. Martin Luther King studied Mahatma Gandhi in India. Mahatma Gandhi was Dr. Martin Luther King's Shiksha Guru. Because he was a Christian minister, and he believed in nonviolence and peace. And he felt that we cannot overcome the prejudice and the laws and the systems of America by force. So taking the same type of psychology and techniques of Mahatma Gandhi, he began the civil rights movement in America and had great impact tremendous impact. Of course, he was murdered in the process. But many, over the last 50 years, many rights have been given that were never there before. His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami was born before the success of Martin Luther King's civil rights movement. He was born in a situation where everything was against him socially. He was born in a violent, poverty-stricken ghetto in Cleveland, Ohio. Freezing cold winters with practically no heat. He was from a broken family. His father left the family before he was even born and never did anything to help them. A single widowed mother had to do everything. Maharaj personally told me that he never had more than two or three sets of clothes at the most. And if a friend would come home whose clothes were more torn than his mother would always give that friend his clothes. Even though she couldn't afford to buy him anything more. Because she wanted to teach her son the spirit of compassion. That it is more important to think in terms of helping others than our own needs. And she lived by that principle her whole life. That had a deep impact in his heart. He was a minority. At that time, the African American people living in the ghettos, the chances were 99.99% that they would live, suffer, and die in the ghetto. It was a very rare hope against hope that they could ever get out and be successful in any field of life. So he was poverty, broken family, minority, persecuted. But that's not all. When he was a young boy, he had a speech defect called stammering, where he could not speak. Sometimes it would take him, he told me, 3 or 4 minutes to speak one word. And when he was a little boy in school and would be called on to speak, if he was asked to speak, he would try to say, "My house." He'd go, "Ma, ma, 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 ha, 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 ha." And he'd be in so much anxiety, he would be slapping his hand against the desk and stomping his feet, trying to say the word, and all the classmates would be laughing at him and joking against him. Very difficult. He was ridiculed even by his own people. That had a great trauma for a small boy. But at the same time, whenever he would speak from the Bible, the teachings of Lord Jesus Christ, he would never stammer. He could speak eloquently. And his Bible studies teachers took note of this and were amazed. And soon he became a child evangelist. He was preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ even on television and radios. And for years he took classes on speech therapy and little by little gradually overcame his speech defect. It was obvious that he was not born in this world to speak about anything material. He was born in this world to glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I will tell you what he personally said about the neighborhood he lived in. It was so violent due to lack of food, lack of law and order, so much suppression and depression. He said people would argue with guns. When he was not even a teenager, the only way he could survive and live amongst his peers was he had to carry a loaded gun with him at all times. Because killings and death were an everyday affair. He told me people would always pick arguments, and if you argued with somebody, it would invariably break out into violence. And if you didn't have a gun, you would probably be shot. If you had a gun, when the argument would meet its peak, you would show your gun, he would show his gun, and then you both realized that one of us are going to die unless we stop arguing. That was life in the ghetto of America. And yet, from his heart of hearts, he was such a humble, compassionate, nonviolent person. But this was the only way to survive. In the ghettos, the best he could get is an inferior education, which practically no proper college would even accept. His name was then John Favors. His mother called him Johnny Boy. He was always so interested in helping others. He became a tutor. And he was giving classes to help other students, both his age and younger than him, to help them in their studies. He really liked to help others. And also he would get paid something very little and be able to help his mother in her hard struggle for existence. How Krishna arranges. Because he was such a genuine person, there was a sangam or like a society where tutors within the Cleveland area would help each other. So he met a Jewish girl, white race, from a very wealthy family. And she understood that this person is such a good-hearted soul. He's so intelligent, so creative. He has so much faith in God. He's so much devoted to whatever he does. He's genuinely good, which is very difficult to find a person like that anywhere. So this girl was thinking that he deserves a chance in life. He has no chance where he's living. So she arranged for the principal of her school, which was the most prestigious prep school for the wealthiest kids in the entire area, for him to go to a summer school. He was the only black person, African person, to ever go to this school. It was in a very wealthy suburb. And during the summer, he performed so well and his characteristics were so attractive that the principal of the school gave him free entrance. And when he graduated from high school at one of the best prep schools of America, the principal told him, "I can get you in any university or college that you want. Just tell me which one and I'll get you in." How is that? Because please understand that this was in the 1960s. This is just after Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson really, really pushed integration of schools for the blacks. I can tell you stories that you would not believe that happened when I was a teenager. The segregation was so strong that just to get an African person in one school, a university in Alabama, the governor of the state, the police force of the state, vowed they would never let an African into their colleges. And the president of the United States, John F. Kennedy, and the attorney general took the domestic army, the National Guard, to fight against the police and the governor. The governor vowed publicly, "We will never allow," and the president said, "This black man is going in your school, or there's going to be a war." Thousands of military, the National Guard, U.S. Army, assembled in Alabama to escort this boy into college. And at the last minute, the government and the local police, they kind of disappeared. Because it would have been major. That's what it took. That's how the government was pushing. So the government was giving incentives of quotas for universities that would never take black people. If you take these African people, we will give you government grants and we will give you tax exemptions. If you do not, no government grants and no tax exemptions. So this was big money. And most colleges and universities are actually existing for money. So they, in order to get the government grants and exceptions, they had to accept so many African people. And most of them they had to take out of the very inferior schools of the ghettos. So this principal said, "I have taught you in one of the top white schools of the country. Any college in America would take you as a first choice. Just tell me where you want to go to college." So he applied, and he got scholarships to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Cornell. Any college, he got full scholarship. So he was just looking for which scholarship is the best. They were canvassing so much for him that Princeton University gave such an offer he couldn't refuse. Free tuition for 4 years, free living expenses, free food, free books, a salary while you're going to school, plus every year two round-trip tickets from Princeton, New Jersey, all the way to Cleveland to visit your parents. Two round-trip airplane tickets. So this is the reason he decided to go to Princeton University. And when he got to Princeton, Maharaj told me all these stories. He said Princeton in those days, in the late 1960s, was mostly the sons of wealthy Southern people. And they hated black people. So he said, to go to classes in Princeton, the only way he could survive, He had to wear his gun every day. When people started pushing him the wrong way, he would just show them the gun and they would leave him alone. But he excelled in his studies. He excelled and became very, very popular. He majored in psychology. He took international law. And he was the president of the student council. And he was the leader of the civil rights movement for that area. He was very much an activist. Gopal Prabhu told me that he went to Princeton University and looked up the yearbook of Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj's graduation year. And there was a picture of him. And they interviewed each person and asked what they hoped to do in the future. And he said that his object was global. He wanted to be a global humanitarian. That was always his heart. He got a graduation degree in psychology. And because he was so proficient, intelligent, creative, dynamic, he got a job for government office. I think it was a legal office. He was given opportunities for work in the United Nations. Here was a man that came from the most downtrodden situation, and now all opportunities were opening before his life for immense influence and material prosperity. Now, usually a person who's really born in poverty, when they have the opportunity for big, high positions in the world with a lot of wealth, they become quite attracted. But he was on a spiritual search. He was reading the scriptures. He met one particular guru, very famous guru who comes from India, who gave wonderful lectures, beautiful singer, personal associate with him. And he was studying and learning under other very, very respected spiritual leaders. And he accepted one person like his guru. But he was asking such deep questions. He wanted to know God. He wanted to love God. He wanted to do the greatest humanitarian work that a person could possibly do. And he had that conviction that God consciousness is the only real and true humanitarian work. He was asking such deep philosophical questions, and he wanted such a high level. He didn't want just artha, dhamma, kama, moksha, which practically everyone in the world is looking to God for. He wanted something more. So finally, after many months, his guru told him, he said, "What you want, I can't give you. You want something so high. You want something so deep. There's only one person in this world who can give you this. And that is A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami of the Hare Krishna movement. But do not tell anybody I told you this." So he began to associate with the devotees at the temple in New York and studying Prabhupada's books. He became a devotee. On one occasion, he had the blessed opportunity of meeting Srila Prabhupada. Now, please understand, at that time, he was one of the only African-American people in the Hare Krishna movement. And devotees didn't know how to deal with him because he was a graduate of psychology from Princeton University, Ivy League school, and at the same time, he's African-American. People were not treating him properly. He told me at the temple he was staying, only two or three people would even talk to him. Others ignored him. So he met Srila Prabhupada, and he very honestly revealed his heart to Srila Prabhupada. He said, "Srila Prabhupada, it hurts my heart to tell you this, but I must. There is racism and prejudice within your movement, amongst your devotees." Maharaj told me that the answer Prabhupada gave him transformed his life. Would you like to hear? Prabhupada could have apologized. He could have said, "No, that is not true." Prabhupada said to him, "If you are affected by what these ignorant devotees say and think, then what is the difference between you and them?" In other words, they're on the bodily conception of life, which is totally contrary to the most fundamental teachings of Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita teaches we are not this body, we are the eternal soul. A real Vaishnav sees the part and parcel of Krishna, the soul in every living being. One who judges another Vaishnav according to race, according to bodily designations, that person, according to the scriptures, has a mentality that lives in hell, naraka, buddhi. So if these people are in the bodily concept of life, if they are ignorant of the basic teachings of Lord Krishna, then they speak and act this way. But if you are affected by what they say, then you're also on the bodily concept of life. So what's the difference between you and them? Srila Prabhupada used that opportunity to just break through the barriers of mundane, superficial consciousness. And at that point, he just became so fearless, so confident that Srila Prabhupada's love and mercy was always with him. On a very auspicious day, he took vows before Srila Prabhupada at the initiation ceremony. And Srila Prabhupada gave him the name Ghanashyam Das. One of his first services was, because he was so highly educated, he was sent to Dallas, Texas, where there was a Gurukula, where he was the personal secretary of Satsvarup Goswami Maharaj. Prabhupada moved that Gurukula to Vrindavan, and Satsvarup Goswami Maharaj entered into the field of book distribution with his party. Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, he would go out in book distribution. In those days, they would do Harinam Sankirtan, and most everyone would distribute Back to Godhead magazines. in the big cities of America. He would sell Prabhupada's big books. It was amazing. His infectious smile, his dynamic personality just charmed everyone's hearts. He would just go out and he was the biggest book distributor in their party. And when they would join this kirtan, he would dance in such an expert way, with so much grace and enthusiasm, that crowds of people would gather around in the streets of America just to see his dance. He actually amazed the American people. One of my dear godbrothers, Mahabodhi Prabhu, he told me some things about Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj which are very sacred and very pleasing to hear. Mahabodhi Prabhu was a graduate of San Diego State University, and he was in the SDS, which is a very radical student activist organization. He was in the student government, and he was revolting against the American government for various discrepancies in their policies. So he became a devotee around just after Ghanashyam Prabhu. And when they met, there was a deep bond between them because they were both college graduates and they were both social activists. And they both knew how to manipulate things in colleges to suit higher purposes. So they were thinking amongst each other, why don't we systematically preach in the colleges? After all, we were students, and we know what the students are like. So many of them are longing for higher answers to the problems of life. People are searching for something spiritual, but what are they getting? If we could give them the absolute truth according to the teachings of Srila Prabhupada, it will transform their lives. And then they saw a letter by Srila Prabhupada. And in this letter, famous letter, Srila Prabhupada said that we must focus on preaching to the college students. Because one college student has the value of over 100 ordinary devotees to the expansion of our movement. So they decided this is really what they wanted to do. So Mahabodhi Prabhu and Ghanashyam Prabhu, they were going to the colleges and distributing books and having kirtans. And while distributing books and having kirtan, they would meet people and they would invite people in the evening for Satsarup Goswami Maharaj's lectures. Soon they were living in vans, just traveling from college town to college town, distributing books, having kirtan, and having preaching programs. When Satsarup Goswami Maharaj was asked to join Prabhupada as his personal secretary for a month, Ghanashyam Prabhu and Mahabodhi Prabhu opened a preaching center in a small house in the college town of San Antonio, Texas. And by the time Satsarup Goswami Maharaj came back, 1 month later, they had made 10 full-time devotees. And all of them were duly initiated by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, in 1 month. This was their in America. This was their enthusiasm. They met Sri Dayananda Goswami Maharaj and said, if you really want to do college preaching, go to Boston. So many colleges are there. So they went to Boston and they started doing book distribution and Harinam and all types of other preaching there. And ultimately they started another preaching center in Yale University, right across the street from the college. And in hardly a month, they made 10 full-time devotees from Yale University and that area. And Mahabodhi Prabhu told me that Ghanashyam, he had so much empathy, so much compassion. He personally took care of all these new devotees like their mother, their father, their best friend, their guide, their servant, their everything. And one feature he said that was very extraordinary is he just loved to serve. He was so enthusiastic to serve everyone. But there's one thing he could not tolerate, and that was anyone trying to serve him. Was very successful. Then one day, they got a phone call from India. It was Rameshwar Prabhu. He told Ghanashyam and Mahabodhi Prabhus that we have had a long talk with Srila Prabhupada. Satsarup Goswami was also present. And Prabhupada wants to establish his books in the universities and in the libraries of the universities throughout all of America. And how he wants to do it? He wants to have a system of selling standing orders. At that time, there was only a few books out. But all the books that Prabhupada was intending to write and publish, they were going to sell those. He said, you should sell complete sets of Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhagavad Gita, and all other books to the colleges, professors, and libraries. Now at that time, Srimad Bhagavatam was only up to about the fourth canto, and Chaitanya Charitamrita hadn't even come out yet. They had to go to the colleges and universities with just a photocopy of the cover of volume one of Chaitanya Charitamrita and convince them to buy, and every time a book is published, you will get it. And Rameshwar Prabhu said that Prabhupada has already named your party. He's named it the BBT Library Party, specially for selling complete sets of his books to the colleges and universities. Begin in America and then go all over the world. This was a bewildering instruction. But Mahabodhi Prabhu told me that Ghanashyam and him went out the first day. They had amazing success. And Ghanashyam, he would just pray so intensely to Prabhupada and Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda to empower him to serve his guru. He was always praying like this, an intense spirit of prayer. He simply wanted to serve and please his spiritual master. It was his one-pointed, exclusive desire in life. He personified the Gita's teaching. Vyavashayatma ka budhir ekeha kuru nandana bahusha ka hyanantasya budhayo vyavashayanam. Those who are on this path, Krishna says, they are resolute in purpose. Their aim is one. The intelligence of those who are irresolute is many-branched. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary of verse, explains, one must make the order of the spiritual master one's life and soul. That was Srila Prabhupada's focus. Ghanashyam Prabhu saw that focus in his Guru Maharaj and took that same spirit within the core of his heart. He prayed. He was so unbelievable. He would take any type of risk. Nothing was impossible. He would go to colleges and meet professors in the most remote departments that had nothing to do with Krishna consciousness by any common person's perspective. And he would just charm those professors so much to buy entire sets of Prabhupada's books. It was unbelievable. Mahabodhi Prabhu came to the conclusion that this Ghanashyam Prabhu is a mystic. He believed that he had mystic cities. Because otherwise, how can you convince these types of people in the way he was doing? They began at Yale University, then the universities around Philadelphia, and they had so much success that Ghanashyam Prabhu, Mahabodhi Prabhu, Satsarup Goswami Maharaj decided they would sell sets of Prabhupada's books to every single college and university in the entire United States of America. And they were doing, going from place to place. First they had a bus, then they broke up in vans, then so many other devotees joined the library party because they saw how much it was pleasing Prabhupada. I want to tell you something of the attributes of Ghanashyam Prabhu. He kept a diary. Every single day, without fail, he would write a message to Srila Prabhupada. He told me this, that he would just write a letter to Sri. He would just speak his heart completely honestly and openly to Srila Prabhupada every single day, praying for his help, praying for his guidance, praying for his mercy, explaining to him what he was doing, how he was doing. This was an integral part of his spiritual life. He was austerity personified. He ate once a day. And what did he eat? He would eat nothing but some fruit, some nuts, and sometimes he would mix a little sour cream with it. And he was traveling in a van with Mahabodhi Prabhu, who was not eating austere prasad. He was making all nice preparations. But he said the amazing thing is even though the part next to him was eating quite opulent foodstuffs, he never budged. He never touched anything except some fruit and nuts. Which is basically what sadhus eat when they go to the forest. No matter what time they would take rest at night, he would arise earlier than 2 o'clock in the morning. He would chant at least 42 rounds every day. Sometimes, and they're living in a van, traveling from place to place. He would be out at the colleges before the colleges would open. And he would be just meeting people and preaching and distributing Prabhupada's books in this very, very systematic way until the last door of the college closed, usually about 10 at night. Then he would have his one meal a day. And oftentimes, if the other devotees in the van, little vans, when they woke up in the middle of the night, they would see Ghanashyam Prabhu with a flashlight, intensely studying Srila Prabhupada's books in a way not to disturb them. He was always chanting and always reading, even in the most difficult situations, and always eager to serve everyone. I will tell you one instant out of thousands and thousands. Would you like to hear?
No!
One day, Ghanashyam Prabhu, Mahabodhi Prabhu, they drove to a small college. The next day, they were supposed to go to a large college, which was many hours away in distance. When they got to this small college, it was deserted. There was no cars in the parking lot. There was no one walking around. Then they found out that the college was closed that day. It was some sort of holiday. So Mahabodhi said, well, let's get out of this place and let's go. Ghanashyam Prabhu said, no, let's try it. Krishna will empower us. Let's try it. Mahabodhi said, are you crazy? There's nobody here. All the offices are closed. The classrooms are closed. The whole college is closed. And they got in a big argument. And finally, Ghanashyam said, all right, but let me just go to the restroom. And I'll be back in 2 minutes. So Ghanashyam went into the college and asked someone where the restroom was. All the halls were deserted. It was just some caretakers. And he went to the restroom. 1 hour went by. 2 hours went by. Mahabodhi Prabhu told me he was very agitated. He's sitting in the car waiting for 2 hours when Ghanashyam Prabhu went to the toilet. Where is he? He was very much becoming disturbed. And then over 2 hours later, Ghanashyam Prabhu comes with his book bag around his shoulder over the hill, back to the car, opened the door, and he was beaming, smiling ecstatically. Mahabodhi Prabhu was about to chastise him. Where were you? What is this? We were supposed to have gone 2 hours ago. But he decided, you know, this person is a mystic. I better hear what he has to say. I better hear what he has to say. He said, as per his word, he went to the toilet. And when he was in the restroom, he happened to see somebody. And he made friends with that. He just started talking to the person who's just, you know what people do in restrooms? This person was going to the toilet. And Ghanashyam is talking to him while he's going to the toilet. And he made friends with him, and the person liked him. And it ended up the person was a professor. He happened to be a professor of Eastern religion. And after talking to him, the professor brought him from the toilet to his office. He said, actually, I'm not supposed to teach today. I just happened to come because I wanted to catch up on some extra work. But I'm so happy to meet you. Ghanashyam charmed his heart. For his own personal purposes, he bought a standing order of all Prabhupada's books. And then he took Bhagavad Gita and decided that he would use this as the textbook for his class for the next year. And Ghanashyam Prabhu said, well, what about your library? Would they like a set of books too for your school library so all the students would have access? He said, well, the library's closed. He said, but the librarian is my friend. Let me call him at home. So he calls the librarian at home. The librarian's wife says, actually, he went to the library. He forgot something there. So he calls him at the library, and Ghanashyam Prabhu went to the library and just preached to the librarian. And within a few minutes, the librarian just was so won over by his qualities, by his compassion, by his enthusiasm, by his love, that the librarian bought an entire standing order of all Prabhupada's books for the university library. Mahabodhi Prabhu said, this is what he did at a small college that was closed. Mahabodhi Prabhu asked him, how did you do that? And Ghanashyam Prabhu said, while I was walking, to the toilet. I was heavily, heavily praying, to Guru and Krishna to give me some service at this college. To give me the chance to serve them by expanding the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And because I made that prayer, miraculously, just the right people happened to be at the right place at the right time. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu prays, Nadanam na janam na sundarim kavitam vaja gadisha kamaye mama janamani janamanishwari bhavata bhakti rahoite kitvai. I do not want wealth. I do not want beautiful women. I do not want name and fame. I do not want to be known as a great scholar. I do not even want liberation from suffering. My only intense prayer is that I may serve you unconditionally, birth after birth after birth after birth. This was Ghanashyam Prabhu's constant prayer. He simply wanted the opportunity to serve by helping Srila Prabhupada expand the Sankirtan movement. After they covered all colleges and universities of America, they went to Europe. Tremendous success. And then they ventured into the most dangerous region of Eastern Europe, which was at that time in the 1970s, the communist bloc. Under communist regime, the government outlawed any religion that did not comply to their state regulations. The KGB was a powerful organization of government agents that practically was spying and doing intelligence investigations on every man, woman, and child. Ghanashyam Prabhu was risking his life against all laws. He was smuggling books into the country. And then he was going to universities and colleges and other such libraries and institutions and convincing professors to buy books that were illegal. Very difficult. But yet such tremendous success. Recently I talked to Gurudas Prabhu, who for some time was in Eastern Europe in some of those countries with Ghanashyam Prabhu. And he explained how they would be doing programs at people's houses that they would preach to, and the KGB would come and they'd have to run out the back door and escape. They were constantly hiding, so much tension, so much anxiety, so much pressure. Sometimes they would sneak into countries because they weren't allowed to be there. And then they had to sneak out because they weren't allowed to go out if they didn't have a stamp of their passport to come in. Otherwise, they'd be put in prison. This was the type of life he was living for Srila Prabhupada's service. And he was so unbelievably successful. On one occasion, he was in a university. And he was just going down the halls, going to various professors, to librarians, trying to convince them to buy all Prabhupada's books. Now, when you're doing this service in that dangerous situation, you always are conscious of being watched. He took note that a very official-looking person was following him. Everywhere he went, every turn he made, this man was right
behind him.
He came to the conclusion, this is an agent of the KGB. And if he's caught by him, it could be imprisonment, it could be death. He tried to blend in, but there was no possibility of him blending in because nobody else looked like him. He was obviously not a student. The man was trailing him everywhere he went. Finally, he realized, I'm going to be arrested. So all of a sudden, he just ran. He was a fast runner. He was running. And he heard the footsteps behind him running. He was running. The person was running, and he was running, and the person was running. And down the hallways of a college was a chase. He was all alone. He took a turn. The other man took a turn. He took another turn. And right, he understood he had to somehow or other disappear from the scene. So he made one very sharp, fast turn and just immediately ran into the first door and closed it behind him before the other man turned. Shila Jayadvaita Swami Maharaj Ki. He turned a corner and opened the door and went in the door, and the KGB man just ran past. But when he walked in this door, there was a very dignified official person sitting behind the desk of a small room. This man was very seriously startled. All of a sudden, this African American man just runs into his room, and he looked at him and said, who are you, and what are you doing here? KGB was somewhere right outside, searching everywhere. He said, he happened to read the name on the door before he went in. He said, you are Professor so-and-so? He said, yes. He said, oh, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I have an appointment to meet you at this time. He said, I'm not aware of any appointment. He said, no, I made an appointment. I came all this way to this just to meet you. I didn't want to break my appointment. He said, I have no recollection of making an appointment. He said, I made an appointment with your secretary. She didn't tell you? He said, no. He said, well, I'm here, and I'd like to discuss some things with you. And he told the person all about Srila Prabhupada's books and how important they would be for him to have in the university library and in his own personal classes. And by the time discussion ended, that professor bought an entire standing order of all Srila Prabhupada's books. This is a story about how when a great devotee has such a deep prayer and commitment to serve his spiritual master and Krishna, how Krishna makes extraordinary and sometimes miraculous arrangements to fulfill that desire for devotional service. Krishna is the supreme creator of all the cosmic manifestation. What is it that he cannot do? And when a devotee with a pure heart wants to be the puppet of his Guru Maharaj, the instrument of the compassion of Krishna, Krishna can make wonderful arrangements to just mystically put us in the right place at the right time with the right person to fulfill our desire. He sent reports to Prabhupada. Prabhupada was simply amazed. On receiving one report, Prabhupada was just shaking his head and smiling in great pleasure. He said that this devotee is amazingly empowered, this Ghanasyam. In these communist countries, he was probably the only black person in the entire country. It's not that he could just blend in, look like everybody else. African people weren't even allowed in those countries in most cases. He was the only African person in the countries, and he stood out. And he's just enthusiastically, he's going through forests and climbing mountains and going to monasteries and meeting people and selling Prabhupada's entire book sets. And these reports gave so much pleasure to Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada profusely blessed him, was so grateful to him. He was an inspiration for devotees all over the world. So determined against all odds, taking all risks, and he did it blissfully. Soon he was the biggest book distributor. He was getting world acclaim. People were really inspired by his austerity, by his sadhana, by his preaching, by his service. I was living on a mountain in New Vrindavan in those days. I didn't even know who the President of the United States was in those days, but I heard of Ghanasyam Prabhu's devotional service. So isolated. But still, he was like the sun. His devotional service like it was like a sun illuminating all directions. While I was with him in the month of May of this year, he told me one story that was very transformational in his life and his service to Srila Prabhupada. In 1976, he was in Mayapur for the Gaur Purnima festival. And most all the members of the library party in Eastern Europe were also there with him. It came to his attention that the other members of the library party were considering resigning because Ghanasyam Prabhu was just putting too much pressure on them. His standards were so high. He was so austere, practically no sleep, practically no eating, just long, long hours of enthusiastically serving without expecting anything in return. It was practically beyond human. So they were just talking, we can't cope with it. The pressure, because he's expecting us to be like that also. And he was a leader. He told me when he got that information, his heart was broken. He was so much in the whirlwind of devotional service, he didn't consider how it was affecting the others. He had no idea that it was affecting them in this way. He felt so crushed, so bad. And he prayed to Srila Prabhupada and thought very deeply and came to the conclusion that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings is to be Gopi Bhartur Bhadakama Layora Das 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 Anu Das. The servant of the servant of the servant of the servant. And the greatest service we can do is encourage others. To discourage others is a disservice. So he decided that better than my own results, which Prabhupada is praising me and so many people are praising me, more important than my own results is to encourage others to get big results. To encourage others in their devotional service. And at that point in Sri Mayapur, India, in 1976, he resolved in his mind that his primary service to Srila Prabhupada is in inspiring and encouraging devotees. He resolved in his mind that his primary service to Srila Prabhupada is in inspiring and encouraging devotees as a selfless servant of the servant of the servant. And it was that spirit that he carried with him for the rest of his life on earth. When Srila Prabhupada was in Vrindavan performing his leela of passing away from this earthly plane, his body had become emaciated. Oftentimes he was unable to eat anything. He was mainly laying in his bed in Sri Krishna Balaram temple, Ramanreti of Vrindavan. But Prabhupada said that my maintenance, that what sustains my life, is the medicine of kirtan. And one of the greatest forms of kirtan is spreading the mission of Lord Chaitanya all over the world. And Prabhupada's favorite medicine was receiving the letters sent by Ghanashyam Prabhu. Tamal Krishna Goswami Maharaj was Prabhupada's personal servant at that time. And he personally told me this. That the highlight always of the day was whenever a letter from Ghanashyam Prabhu came. Because Bhakti Charu Maharaj, a servant, and Tamal Krishna Goswami Maharaj, the secretary, they knew how much joy and enthusiasm Prabhupada experienced when he received Ghanashyam Prabhu's reports. They were reports of the greatest mystery and adventure and total surrender against all odds and miracles just manifesting one after another. And Srila Prabhupada, one day he just shook his head and smiled. This is in his last months in Vrindavan. And he just remarked, how much potency this boy has. He's practically preaching in the jungle of Eastern Europe. He's black, a different color than all of them. He doesn't speak the language at all, and yet he's selling hundreds of complete sets, standing orders of my books. Prabhupada said, this is amazing. Prabhupada would have Ghanashyam Prabhu's letters read over and over again to him. And whenever distinguished God brothers or Vrindavan guests or Delhi guests would come, he would often have Tamal Krishna Goswami read to them Ghanashyam Prabhu's reports. Srila Prabhupada was so proud of his loving disciple. Srila Prabhupada's causeless mercy, he reciprocated so lovingly with his devotees. Because his disciples all over the world were giving up so much and surrendering their lives to help him. And he wanted to reciprocate with their love. Here he was, emaciated. There was nothing but a thin layer of skin covering his bones. His doctor said, if you travel, you die. But Prabhupada decided, I will go to London and then I will go to America to inspire the devotees. He couldn't give lectures, but he just wanted to go there just to show how grateful he was for what they were doing. He wanted to be with them just to show his love for them. That was Srila Prabhupada. They had to carry him, lay him in a car, carry him, lay him on a seat of an airplane, carry him through on a wheelchair through immigrations and customs, carry him to his room at Bhaktivedanta Manor. At that time, devotees from all over the European continent were coming to see Srila Prabhupada. It was a grand festival. But when they saw his physical conditions, their hearts were broken. But at the same time, they were in such ecstatic joy. Prabhupada's love for them was the love of the spiritual world. It was absolutely unconditional. It was Krishna's love. Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj told me that when he got the news that Prabhupada was coming to the Bhaktivedanta Manor in London, he was in Eastern Europe, and he drove practically non-stop with Krishna Kshetra Prabhu and Bhakti Dayal Prabhu. They drove all the way to London. And when Tamal Krishna Goswami Maharaj found out that Ghanashyam Prabhu was there, he was rejoicing. This will make Prabhupada so happy. Because there was no greater happiness to the devotees than Srila Prabhupada's happiness. Whatever would make Prabhupada happy was the life and soul of every devotee. So Prabhupada's personal entourage, they understood what could make Prabhupada happier than seeing Ghanashyam Prabhu. His reports were the happiest, brightest moments. So Tamal Krishna Goswami personally went down and brought Ghanashyam Prabhu by the hand into Srila Prabhupada's quarters. He offered his prostrated obeisances to his Guru Maharaj. Srila Prabhupada smiled ear to ear with tears in his eyes to see his beloved Ghanashyam. He said, come here, come here. He came right up to Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada embraced him with tears of love and gratitude. And then he rubbed Ghanashyam Prabhu's head and said, your life is successful. Thank you very much. Prabhupada said this with tears of gratitude in his eyes. And then Prabhupada expressed from his heart, he said, this is the parampara system, as he rubbed Ghanashyam Prabhu's head with deep affection. This is the parampara system. My Guru Maharaj pushed me, and now I am pushing you, and you are pushing others to spread the mission of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. This was a type of mercy that was very, very rare. For Prabhupada to be crying and embracing and rubbing the head of a disciple was something very special. Soon all the devotees of Europe throughout Bhaktivedanta Manor were hearing about the good fortune of Ghanashyam Prabhu, the special mercy he received from Srila Prabhupada. How many of you have heard this story before? Now, there's a part of the story that Maharaj told me just a few months ago. Part two. Devotees all over Europe were all in Bhaktivedanta Manor. No one got this mercy. Prabhupada crying, Prabhupada embracing, Prabhupada rubbing head, Prabhupada saying, your life is successful. You are carrying on the parampara. So Tamal Krishna Goswami was so moved by Prabhupada's pleasure. He was always thinking how to please Prabhupada more. So he had an idea, a fantastic idea, that because Ghanashyam Prabhu brought a new report with him and gave it to Tamal Krishna Goswami to read. Tamal Krishna Goswami Maharaj said, it will bring Prabhupada the greatest joy. For the first time ever, you please come and read the report personally to Srila Prabhupada. Oh, this was such an honor and pleasure for Ghanashyam Prabhu. So Tamal Krishna Goswami Maharaj said, today Srila Prabhupada, Ghanashyam Prabhu will read the report to you of his preaching activities in Eastern Europe. Ghanashyam Prabhu was very reverential toward Prabhupada and quite nervous about doing this. But on the order of Goswami Maharaj, he started to read. Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj told me, as he was reading, Srila Prabhupada looked totally disinterested. He didn't even look like he wanted to listen. He's reading, and Prabhupada's just talking to someone here, looking this way. And he was getting very nervous. He read one page. It was several pages. He read one page, and he really felt that he was disturbing Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada actually was looking just disinterested. And then Prabhupada stopped him and looked at him with a very grave, stern expression. And Ghanashyam Prabhu stopped reading. Prabhupada spoke. Krishna is the doer. Ghanashyam Prabhu was practically paralyzed. And Tamal Krishna Goswami, who watched the whole thing, he said, Ghanashyam Prabhu, I think it's time for you to leave now. So he offered his obeisances and came outside. And Maharaj told me that was one of the most intimate, loving experiences he's ever had in his life. Prabhupada's love for him. The first day, he embraced him. He cried tears of affection. He stroked his head and said, your life is successful. You are carrying on parampara. And the next day, it's not that Ghanashyam Prabhu did anything wrong that day. He just came in the next day, and Prabhupada just ignored him and instructed him. Krishna is the doer. Do not expect any credit for yourself. Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj told me, all over the world, they know the first part of the story. Said, but for me, my favorite part of the whole story is the second part. Because that's when Prabhupada showed the most intimate, special love toward me. He showed his deep love and his deep gratitude, but at the same time wanted to protect him for all time to come. And Ghanashyam Prabhu said, those were the last words Prabhupada personally spoke to him. Krishna is the doer. And after going out of the room and offering his obeisances and thinking about it, he was ecstatic because he knew it was Prabhupada's most intimate love and mercy. Soon after this, in November of 1977, Srila Prabhupada departed from the world. The closing chapter of his pastimes on this earth caused the whole world of ISKCON to drown in an ocean of separation. Ghanashyam Prabhu was one of such persons. The thunderbolt of the news of Prabhupada's disappearance just struck our hearts and cast us into a realm of intense spiritual pain. We were only living to please Srila Prabhupada. We were only living for the next time he would come and see what we have done. But now he was not going to come anymore. Ghanashyam Prabhu, he took the order of his spiritual master as his life and soul. After Srila Prabhupada departed from this world, and for some years after that, many of his disciples fell away from their spiritual practices. Many removed themselves from the mission for various reasons. But a few people, including Ghanashyam Prabhu, felt that deep determination to follow in Prabhupada's footsteps. When Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur left this world, Srila Prabhupada made the order he gave him his life and soul. And even almost 40 years later, he went to the West and established the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Ghanashyam Prabhu deeply studied Prabhupada's life and teachings and understood love for my guru means surrender to his order, love and separation. Soon the library party, I believe, after they finished Eastern Europe, they covered South America. Now, one place in the world that was most difficult to preach, very, very difficult. In fact, so difficult that the few people that preached there were usually getting so sick and getting in so much trouble that it was intolerable. West Africa. Very difficult. Leaders of ISKCON appealed to Ghanashyam Prabhu to go to West Africa to preach. They are the people of your race. And you have received Prabhupada's mercy. Share it with them. He went. Very difficult. In 1978, Ghanashyam Prabhu came to New Vrindavan to accept the vows of a sannyasi. He decided to take sannyas from Kirtanananda Swami Maharaj. I was there for that ceremony. I would like to tell you a few things that I remember. But before telling you that, I'm going to tell you something else, very personal. It was in about 1973 or 4 that I first met Ghanashyam Prabhu. He came to New Vrindavan. And I remember we sat in this weeded field for hours and hours and hours talking about Prabhupada and Krishna. Just pure Krishna katha. And from that time, we developed a very deep, loving friendship. And when he told me his name, Ghanashyam, I told him about a person named Ghanashyam that I once knew in Vrindavan Dham. And I told him many stories about Ghanashyam Baba. And one story that really struck him was how whenever I would come before Ghanashyam Prabhu, he would always fold his hands and greet me, "I am your obedient servant. I am your obedient servant." And after some time, he wouldn't even say servant. Ghanashyam would just address me with tears in his eyes, with such heartfelt humility. He would say, "I am your obedient." And after I told him this, Ghanashyam Prabhu, with folded hands and tears in his eyes, he said, "I am your obedient." And then I said to him, "I am your obedient." And from that time, in about 1973, this was always the way we addressed each other. With so much affection and joy, "I am your obedient." And whenever he would say it, there was just so much intimacy, sweetness, and love in his heart. "I am your obedient." It was in about 1973, he was in India, and he went with a few devotees to Jagannath Puri. At that time, in history, I do not believe a single foreign devotee of ISKCON had ever been inside Jagannath's temple. Now, in one exchange between Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj and Prabhupada, Prabhupada was so pleased with his service that Prabhupada told him, "You will see Krishna in this lifetime." So Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj was thinking, maybe I'll see Krishna as Jagannath in this lifetime. So he was thinking, "I have a very black complexion. Perhaps they'll think I'm from South India." "And they will allow me in." But he knew they banned, in those days, they even banned Indian devotees from ISKCON. Because they considered that Indian devotees were associating with Western devotees. So they had no right to enter into Jagannath's temple. So he was thinking, "I'll wear Karmi clothes. I'll wear regular civilian dress. then they'll never think I'm from ISKCON. But he didn't have any karmic clothes. So he just asked some people, and he borrowed a set of clothes that didn't even fit him, just some pants and shirt. And then he tied a gumsha around his head because his head was shaved with sika. And there were big crowds. And he walked right through the gatekeepers. And he went deeper and deeper, and it was mass crowds of people. Thousands and thousands of people in that hall. And he went by the Garuda Stamba, and people were having a very difficult time coming close to Jagannath. But he saw Jagannath from a great distance. But meanwhile, he was just praying to Jagannath, if they catch me now that I'm inside, they're going to beat me. They're going to really beat me. I don't know what will happen. So all of a sudden, the pandas and the pujaris, they just stopped all the crowds. And they were choosing people that they thought they had money and called them forward. And one of the pandas called Bhakti Tirtha Swami, who was in disguise. He said, "You, come." But he said it in Orient language. And Bhakti Tirtha Swami was really afraid because he's going to talk to him. And he only speaks English. He doesn't speak any language except English. So he was thinking, what am I going to say? I'll tell him that I'm an Indian, but I was brought up in America and I only know English. So the person started talking to him, and he didn't say anything. He was asking him questions, very seriously asking him questions. And he, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, couldn't understand a word he was saying, and he didn't know what to respond, so he just remained silent as if he was playing to Lord Jagannath. So the person actually brought him right up to the altar, right up to the altar, and pushed his head right on the altar near Jagannath Baladev and Subhadra's lotus feet, and let him stand right inches from Jagannath Baladev Subhadra to offer his prayers of love. Then he took him to circumambulate Jagannath Baladev and Subhadra. And meanwhile, so many other pandas wanted to try to get money from him, but this one panda was saying, "He's mine, he's mine." And then in the end, after he had this amazing darshan of Jagannath, he offered prayer. He told me that he prayed. He prayed to Lord Jagannath to protect all the devotees in ISKCON, to give them pure bhakti, and to empower them to please Srila Prabhupada by spreading the mission all over the world. This was his only prayer, that he could be an instrument of mercy and compassion in his life, and that all the devotees would be happy in Krishna consciousness. That was his prayer to Jagannath. Then as this pujari, who was a chief pujari, was escorting him out, he spoke to him in English. He said, "I know who you are." He said, "I don't agree that you people should not be allowed in the temple. So I have given you this darshan." And Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj told us it was such a divine spiritual experience that the next day he thought he'll do it again. Actually, it was that night. Yes, it was that same night. So late at night, he again put on the gumsha on his head and put on his unfitting civilian clothes. And he walked in And then Pandas discovered him. He was an Indian, and they started screaming at him and chasing him, and he had to run away, and people were trying to stop him. But he said he was in very good condition. So he ran and ran, and people were trying, and he finally just ran out of the Singhadwaram. And then he realized that we should be satisfied with what Krishna has given us. But as far as I know, he was the first foreign devotee of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness to ever personally have the darshan of the Ishtadeva of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Jagannath Baladev Subhadramai, Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj Ki. Prabhupada's prophecy came true. You will see Krishna in this life. He loved his name, Ghanashyam, which is Krishna's name, which means he is beautiful, beautiful like a dark monsoon rain cloud. And he used to tell me that Prabhupada gave me perfect name because I'm very dark. But how a monsoon rain cloud pours showers and showers of rain upon fields and rivers that are just drying up. In the same way, Krishna showers his mercy on those living entities within this world who are just drying up, starving due to forgetfulness of him, being burnt by the scorching heat of material existence. Krishna showers his sweet mercy. Therefore, he is Ghanashyam. He loved his name, Ghanashyam Prabhu. Oh, how he loved it. Prabhupada gave him that name. So he came to New Vrindavan at the Radha Vrindavan Chandra Temple in Bahulaban. And first he sat at the fire as a brahmachari, Ghanashyam Prabhu. And then he was asked to go out of the room and change into sannyasi cloth. And I remember a very dear devotee named Sri Galim. He helped, because he was at one time personal servant of Vishnu Jana Maharaj. He taught Ghanashyam Prabhu how to put on the clothes of a sannyasi, because it's different than brahmachari clothes. So he came out, then the lecture was given, and then Kirtanananda Maharaj handed him the danda and said, your new name will be Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. And I was looking at Ghanashyam Prabhu's face. He was shocked. He couldn't believe he changed my name. Because Prabhupada practically never changed a person's name. He just, if you were Satsvarup Das, you became Satsvarup Goswami. Vishnu Jan Das, Vishnu Jan Goswami. Tamal Krishna Das, Tamal Krishna Goswami. Yes? It was very, very unheard of to change a person's name. And I looked at his face. I was looking at him. And he said, your new name is Bhakti Tirtha Swami. First, I saw in his face, like, shock. Like, what did you do? I could see in his eyes, he was saying, I'm attached to my name, Ghanashyam. You just changed it. And then I saw just a huge smile on his face and just totally blissful, just... Because sannyas means surrender, renunciation. And he just blissfully accepted the name Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. And after taking his vows and receiving the sannyas mantra, there was the fire yajna. And after the fire yajna, there was a kirtan in front of the beautiful deities of Radha Vrindavan Chandra. Devotees from all over New Vrindavan were gathered, men, women, and children, ecstatically chanting. This was the first kirtan of Bhakti Tirtha Swami. And he was so ecstatic. He was so energized, just renouncing his life for Prabhupada's service. The spirit of sannyas means your body, your mind, your words, and your life exclusively property of Guru and Krishna. And there's no other consideration. That is sannyas. And he took those vows with the true spirit that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and all the acharyas had taken sannyas. Not for fame, not for prestige, not for position, but for service, absorption. So he was ecstatic. And for the first time in history, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj danced with a danda. Now later on, it became a legendary pastime, but this was the first. And he was dancing wild, wild, magnificent, graceful, but dancing ecstatically with his danda in his hand and his sannyas cloth. And at one point, he just leaped high in the air, calling out, Haribol! And his danda raised up in his raised arms. And right when he was way high in the air, his dhoti fell off. Just fell right off onto the ground, and he was just in midair in his kopans, his loincloth. And with one hand, he was trying to grab his dhoti, and the other hand, his hat is done, and it was a culture shock for him. And then he just picked up his dhoti and tried to just really quickly just cover his loincloth. And I remember I said to him, I said, Maharaj, you are really renounced. Said, Maharaj, you are following in the footsteps of the six Goswamis. They also only wore kopans. And he was really embarrassed. He said, I don't know what to do. I said, maybe we should go outside and try to put it on better. So he went outside and he tied such a tight knot to that dhoti. He just tied it and pulled it and made a double knot and pulled it and then went right back into the kirtan, grabbed his danda and started dancing in ecstasy. But in the meanwhile, when he was dancing, all the men, women, and children were all in a big circle around him when his dhoti fell off. And the men were like shocked, and the women were covering their faces with their saris, and the children were laughing. That was the first kirtan of Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. And when he came back into the temple room was so surcharged because, you know, we were thinking he was embarrassed or something, but he just came in with this gigantic ear-to-ear brilliant smile with those white teeth just glistening and radiating energies. And he started dancing and he got everybody dancing. The whole temple was shaking and shaking and shaking for hours and hours and hours. On the request of his godbrothers, he based himself in Africa. When he went there, the movement had a couple fledgling centers that were falling apart. Very difficult. It was just so impossible to preach there. I believe he first went to Nigeria. And practically all the preaching. Prabhupada said, one time Prabhupada came to Kenya, where they opened a center in Nairobi, and so many Indian people came. And Prabhupada chastised. He said, it's nice so many Indian people are coming, but Africa isn't a place of Africans. Why are you not preaching to the Africans? The reason was because it was so difficult. Nobody knew how. But Bhakti Tirtha Swami, he just had such determination, such a creative intelligence, empowered by Krishna. He was just making dozens and dozens and dozens of devotees, opening centers, starting farm communities. It was incredible what he was doing. He told us how difficult preaching in Africa was. Would you like to hear a few things? He said, for a person who's not born and raised in Africa, there are so many diseases. Far worse than India. That's one of the reasons any person from the West, from the Hare Krishna movement, could not survive in Africa. So many diseases. Always getting sick. He said the food that the devotees cooked for him was unpalatable. He could never digest it. And it just tasted obnoxious. He said that when you make these tribal people, when they turn against you, you make their son or their daughter a devotee, you don't know what's going to happen. It's a regular thing amongst those people. If you want to kill someone, you put poison in their food. He was getting threats from the parents of the devotees that they would poison him. And other persons were practicing voodoo. Do you know what is voodoo? It is like an African type of tantricism. And they put curses. And the curses are actually effective. Those voodoo curses can torture people, can cause people to go insane, to cause people illnesses, terminal illnesses. The voodoo curses have the power to kill people. And all sorts of people were putting voodoo curses on him. Powerful people. People were hiring voodoo priests to put curses on him. But he persevered. Very difficult. But one of the most difficult things is the instability in the governments. Because he was telling us that if you didn't have government support, they would crush you. But the problem is, if the government supports you and you become in any way close to the government, then if another party takes over the government, you're finished. Because it's a very revolutionary place. They have political coups. Happens all the time in West Africa. Where some party of mafia people or gangsters or military just forcibly, violently take over the government. And there's certain regulative principles of what you do when you you kill the prime minister, you kill the president, you kill all the cabinet members, and you kill any party that's close to the previous government. And the coups are happening regularly. And they were happening regularly while he was there. So he explained that if you don't come close to the government, they'll crush you, they'll shut you down. And if you do get close to the government, if there's a military or mafia takeover, then you're going to be killed because you're close to the previous government. So with such intelligent sensitivity, he had to simultaneously achintya beta beta tattva. He had to get close enough to get the support of the government, but far enough so that if there was a takeover, and the takeovers did come while he was there, that they didn't connect you as being close to them. very tense, anxiety-ridden situation. And for a person from America, the heat of West Africa was oppressing. And they had no air conditioners. It's a very, very poor country. And the people he was preaching to were mostly tribal people, very, very poor. City, but still very poor. No facilities. Very primitive circumstances, disease, heat, death threats, voodoo curses. And yet, despite all that, and there was even revolutions amongst the devotees, taking over the temples. And some of the top devotees were threatening to kill him. Very difficult. But he stayed. And what happened in Africa? Because of his determination, his enthusiasm, his dedication, and his incredible compassion, it was expanding like nowhere else in the world. Soon, he was regularly on every major television station preaching. He was in all the media, major newspapers, major magazines, major radio shows. He became a national hero. The prime ministers, the presidents, the heads of states were coming for spiritual guidance from him. In fact, he was awarded the highest civilian honor a person could get. He was made an honorary chief of the Wari tribe in Nigeria. That's the highest position a civilian could get. There was a whole ceremony where they coronated him the king of a tribe. He had such immense influence. He became a spiritual counselor for Nelson Mandela. He became a spiritual counselor for, at that time, in the 1980s, this person was voted the most popular man in the entire planet Earth. Time magazine, Life magazine, they all came together and they made a poll amongst the people of the world, the most popular man on Earth. And at that time, who was it? Muhammad Ali. Now, you are all from Tirupati, Bombay, India. I do not know if you know who is Muhammad Ali. But he was the world champion fighter. He was the athlete of all athletes. He was another success story. He was born in the ghettos of Louisville, Kentucky, downtrodden. Just to survive, he had to learn how to fight. And he made it into an art and a science. And he became the world champion boxer. His name was Cassius Clay. And he was a pacifist. Because at that time there was a Vietnam War. And he was drafted to go into the military. And he filed as a conscientious objector. That means according to his religion, he adopted Islam as his religion. According to his religion, he follows nonviolence. He cannot fight or be violent. It would be nice if all people of that faith followed this principle. Of course, he was beating people up like anything in the boxing ring. But that was an occupation. So he went to prison for nonviolence. And that just increased his popularity more. So now here he's the most popular man in all the world. Very difficult to meet somebody like this, so high in the public eye. And Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj was regularly going to his house to give him spiritual guidance. He was confiding in Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj. He was telling Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj's problems and asking him how to overcome his weaknesses. Yes, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj was becoming so influential in the world that the United Nations was calling for him for counseling, guidance, and advice. Heads of countries were calling for him. Celebrities. In the early 1980s, during apartheid, in Durban, South Africa, was the grand opening of the Radharadhanath Temple. Magnificent, one of the most beautiful temples in all the world. Nelson Mandela was the chief guest. The devotees of the leaders of ISKCON called Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj to come to South Africa to give the opening address representing ISKCON. One of the most historical speeches ever given in ISKCON. There were the leaders of all the various religions and all the various political parties. Everyone was there for this function. Yes, Gopal? And Bhakti Tirtha Swami's address just enthralled everyone's hearts. He spoke so powerfully, so convincingly, so charmingly. Then he announced the welcoming of Nelson Mandela. And Nelson Mandela, so impressed by Bhakti Tirtha Swami's words and his incredible devotion, just came to the stage and embraced Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj. And from that point on, they were dear friends. Nelson Mandela, on many occasions, they met and received spiritual guidance from His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. So during that time, he was preaching, besides Africa, in Washington, D.C. And a very creative genius, he created the Institute for Applied Spiritual Technology. In the same spirit as the Bhaktivedanta Institute, a very specialized way of preaching to specialized type of people. So he had his institute right in the heart of Washington, D.C., in a beautiful house just down the road from the White House where the president lived. Very prestigious location. And at that time, I was just staying in Bombay about 11 months a year. And just to keep the connection to New Vrindavan, because if I didn't keep the connection, it could have been a very political difficulty. I mean, it could have been upheavals. There were even traces of it happening. Very difficult. I was trying to keep politics away. So during my time in America, when I would first come and before I'd leave, I would drive a van to Washington, D.C. to spend several days with Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj. And those days were so intensely intimate and sweet. We would have conversations every day that would last 14 or 15 hours. We would go to the morning program. After the morning program, we'd sit around a little table and take prasad and start talking. And then after prasad, we'd sit and talk. And then the conversation would carry on as we, about 6 hours later, when we'd sit around a table and eat lunch prasad. And we'd carry on talking. Sometimes we'd walk through the forest or something. And the conversation would carry on until night. And usually at about midnight, we'd still be talking. And then he'd put these two sheets on the floor, because we both sleep on the floor. And we both lay on the floor next to each other to go to sleep. And we'd usually end up talking until about 4 in the morning. And then we'd get up. We didn't even sleep. We just laid there talking. And then we'd get up for Mangal Arati. And then the whole morning program. And then start talking again. Very intimate, soul-searching, loving discussions. Pouring our hearts out to one another. We really bonded in a very special and unique way as friends at that time. Of course, you know, later on we both understood that what ISKCON leadership had done was really the right thing that had to be done. But somehow or other, we were in a circumstance where we both prayed to Prabhupada from the core of our hearts and heard his calling that we should continue the service that we were doing to protect the devotees. So many wonderful, wonderful, wonderful devotees. Somehow protect them and keep them in Krishna consciousness beyond all this stuff happening. I remember one... Should I continue? When I was one of the people who for years was assisting me in my preaching to colleges was one of my god sisters. I'd like to tell you a little about her. You see, what would happen is I would give classes in the colleges on philosophy and the Gita, sociology, history, and just speak bhakti to them from different points of view. And we were doing harinams, and we were doing book tables, and we were doing cooking classes, and any creative way to somehow get people to come. We were having Sunday programs, and soon every night of the week, we had programs at different colleges, and gradually people came forward and became devotees, and then those people from those towns actually sponsored and started the temples. It was very wonderful. But I was the main person that was cultivating people. And almost half the people coming who were really taking serious interest were ladies. And I began the project as a brahmachari, but at this time I was a sannyasi. And I felt that women should be preaching to cultivate intimately these women. So I went to one of my god sisters, who was one of the most spontaneously enthusiastic lovers of Krishna I have ever seen in my life. Her name was Ladini. Now, Ladini was the pujari for Jagannath Baladev and Subhadra for many years. She was the head pujari at Madhuban Farm. Well, what happened is she was getting dreams of Lord Nityananda Prabhu, who told her to go out and preach. And then she'd have dreams of Balaram, saying, "How could you leave me? You have to stay and take care of me. You're my pujari." So she didn't know what to do. One night she'd have a dream, Nityananda saying, "All this ringing of the bells is for neophytes, go out and preach." And then Balaram, who's Lord Nityananda, would say, "But your ringing of your bells and your puja is giving me great pleasure. You cannot leave me. You must continue being pujari." So she would write me all these letters. I still have some of them. Where she would tell, she would be trying to get guidance. What should I do? So finally, Nityananda Prabhu
was victorious.
So finally, Nityananda Prabhu was victorious. And she got deities of Gornitai. And she went out and she wanted to know what to do. She came to me, she said, I need to preach. Nityananda Prabhu wants me to preach. Nityananda Prabhu wants me to preach. But I don't know anything about preaching. I've been living on this farm covered with mud, doing pujari work and cutting wood and cooking for the last 15 years. What should I do? I said, I know exactly what you should do. We'll get you a van and you start a women's party and travel to all these college preaching centers and preach to all the women and cultivate them and make them devotees. So she said, yes, I'm very enthusiastic. But she kept one of Balaram's shoes. And for her whole life, the shoe of Balaram was her pillow. It was a wooden shoe, too. She always slept her head on the shoe of Balaramji, wooden sandal, to always be in Balaram's service in the form of Lord Nityananda Prabhu. And I remember one time in, I think it was Cincinnati or Columbus, we were doing a Harinam and we had a book table and she had her, wherever we did anything, she would always set up her Gornitai deities, about this big. And the police came and arrested us. I was not there at the time because I would be traveling different places. But the police came to arrest, and Ladini, she said, you cannot arrest us without arresting them. She pointed to the deities. They said, they're those dolls? Arrest dolls? She said, no, they are not dolls. It is on their order that we are here chanting the holy names and distributing books and prasad. It is on their order. How can you arrest us without arresting them? And she spoke with such conviction. They said, what are you talking about? What are you talking? Arrest? They're not even people. She said, no, they are people. We are here under their order. You cannot arrest us without arresting them. So the police arrested the deities. And they took the devotees and the deities to jail for doing Harinam Kirtan without permit or something like that. And when they went to see the magistrate, she was saying the same thing. She was saying she brought the deities with her. She is under our order. They have ordered us. Krishna is your mother. Krishna is your father. Krishna is your life and soul. Krishna is your treasure. Chant Hare Krishna. Worship Krishna. Follow the teachings of Krishna. They have ordered us to give this message all over the world. We're helpless. Whatever your laws are, we cannot follow them. Because they have given us their instruction. And she spoke with such conviction that the magistrate, the judge, actually said, well, if you're following their instructions, then how can I arrest you? Just go out and follow their instructions. She didn't need a lawyer. She had her Gornitai as her advocate. This was her faith. But when I was there, you know, she was doing unbelievable. I'll tell you something about her. Her love for Krishna was so contagious that any female student or townsperson that I would connect to her, that person could not give up her association. They had to become devotees. They just wanted to help her in every way. They became blissful. She was just love of God personified. Amazing person. But then when I was sent to India and had to stay there, And later on, New Vrindavan, they made many changes. There was no kirtans. There was no devotee dress. So many things. And she was so deeply immersed in Chaitanya Charitamrita and the traditions of Gaudiya Vaishnavism that these changes were breaking her heart. When I came, she was crying. She said, I can't stay here. I can't follow this. But I don't want to offend anyone. Please help me. So Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj came to New Vrindavan. And Fladini and I went to New Vrindavan. And he gave a class where he was talking about the incredible preaching he was doing in Africa. So about a week later, she asked me, do I have your blessings to go to Africa? Because there, I could just worship Lord Nityananda without all these restrictions. So I said, let us talk with Maharaj. So she drove her van, I drove mine. We met at the Institute for Applied Spiritual Technology, and the three of us met in Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj's room. It was a very deep, wonderful talk. She practically didn't say a word. I had to do all the speaking. She was just sitting there with her tears in her eyes. And in the end, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj just, he said, this is the greatest benediction for Africa, to get a devotee like you. Is this really what you want? And then she said, Maharaj, please accept me as your servant. And she went to Africa. Now, should I tell you an interesting story about Ladini? She was superbly excellent at preaching to people one-on-one, but she had never given a class in her life. She always longed to go to Vrindavan. So one time I arranged for her to come to India. And we took her to Vrindavan, Govardhan, Parikrama, Barsana, Nandagaon, so many places. She was intoxicated with spiritual love the whole time she was there. It was amazing to see her. And then we brought her back to Bombay. And at that time, Radha Gopinath Temple was just a little dungeon downstairs with rats and roaches and so-called brahmacharis. And we weren't even allowed to come at that time. Brahmacharis didn't like us. You remember? So we were having our Bhagavatam classes at Srinathji Prabhu's house. So one day I asked Ladini that you please give class today. And she just froze like a statue. She said, no, I've never given a class. I cannot give a class. No, I will not give a class. And I said, Ladini Devi, please give Bhagavatam class. They would love to hear from you. She said, these are all civilized, cultured people, and I'm like an animal. I'm a beast. How can I give class to them? I have no qualification. I don't know the philosophy. This is the one thing I cannot do. I will not give class. She said, I'll leave this place if you make me give class. I can't do it. I won't do it. I said, all right, I'll give class. So we were all sitting. There was about 20, 25 devotees gathered in Srinathji Prabhu's living room at Seaface Park. And I chanted Jai Radha Madhava, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Read the Sanskrit, the verse, the purport. And then I said, and now Fladini Mataji will give class. And I got up and walked right out. And she said, no, no, no. And I just kept walking and I closed the door and I locked the door. So she and just went out of the house and went down the stairs and she couldn't find me. And meanwhile, she was sitting there. And the devotees put the book in front of her, put the microphone in front of her. And what could she do? She started speaking. A few minutes later, I came back up the stairs, and I opened the door a little crack so she wouldn't see me to listen. And she was preaching. Magnificent class. She was preaching with such enthusiasm. At the beginning, she was just, for the first 10 minutes, she just apologized for not being qualified. And then she gave about a two-hour class. And the devotees were enthralled. They were spellbound. And after that day, she never stopped giving Srimad Bhagavatam classes. So when she went to Africa, soon she was leading Harinam Sankirtan parties and getting hundreds of little African kids to dance and chant, just what she loved to do. She was cooking prasad and distributing it to them. She was really a mother. She was giving fantastic classes to the devotees, and soon she was on television, radio, magazines, newspaper interviews. Practically every day she was a media sensation. Heads of state, government officials were coming to take shelter of her. She was doing unbelievable preaching. She was totally fearless. And it was Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj's inspiration. They had such a deep connection. Anyways, it's a long story. But after some years, there was a political takeover in Liberia, where she happened to be preaching. And her and about 8 other devotees were killed. They were shot dead. What happened is they invaded this gangster mob that took over the government, raided the temple in the middle of the night, and lined up all the men to kill them, and told Ladini, because you're a woman, we're not going to harm you. You can go. But they shot one of the devotee men, and she couldn't tolerate it. A few weeks before this incident, she wrote me a letter. And she said, the only thing in life that I fear is offending a Vaishnav. There's no other fear I have in life. And she was telling me about the life and death situation in Liberia. When they started shooting devotees, she cried out, you cannot do this. You cannot kill devotees. And she literally, there was military people with guns all around, rifles, and the leader was shooting with a pistol. She ran right up to the leader and grabbed his arm so he couldn't kill the devotees. She said, you cannot do this. You cannot do this. She knew that she would be killed. She literally, physically grabbed the hand of the president of the nation who took over the government, for he wouldn't shoot the devotees. And they just aimed their guns at her and killed her. She would rather die than stand idly as devotees were being killed. That was her integrity. Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj had such deep gratitude, appreciation for Ladini. Their relationship on a totally, purely spiritual level was something extraordinary. After she passed away, Maharaj told me that in previous life she had male body, and they were both devotees, and they were most intimate, loving friends, like brothers. He said that our relationship is so deep on such a spiritual platform that goes back to previous births. Maharaj, should I continue? It's getting late. If you want to take prasad, please go. If you want to hear about Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, you will be much more benefited. Because prasad will be there till any time. While he was doing these heroic devotional deeds in Prabhupada's service in Africa, at the same time, he was developing one of the most successful projects in the world in the capital of America, Washington, D.C. The Institute of Applied Spiritual Technology was reaching so many people. Maharaj was having classes at, I believe it was Howard University. A very highly esteemed educational institute in Washington, D.C. Maharaj was such a compassionate person. To be a preacher, it's not just a matter of speaking philosophy. It's a matter of transforming people's hearts, awakening love of God in people's hearts, getting people to be deeply attached to the association of devotees and the holy name of Krishna. Now, Srila Prabhupada, when he came to America, he saw so many millions of innocent souls who are part and parcel of Krishna, who were being cheated and exploited by Maya. We have to save them. Prabhupada made many adjustments in the presentation of Krishna consciousness to reach the people according to Kaladesha Patra, the time, place, and circumstance, but without ever changing the message. So Maharaj saw in the 1980s, it wasn't like the 60s and 70s, there wasn't many people joining the movement. We had to somehow or other reach them in a way that was relevant to their interest. So he explored grounds that were very interesting. He targeted which types of people are going to be most inclined to accepting Krishna consciousness. So he was giving seminars and lectures, appealing to the New Age people. He was giving lectures from a point, Krishna consciousness from the point of view of psychology, psychiatry, conflict resolution, politics. He was giving lectures on UFOs, unidentified flying objects. All these various occult subjects. He was reaching people's hearts. And it was considered controversial. We don't accept these things. But what was the result? The result is he would gain people's confidence. He would gain people's love. And then he would gradually train them in Krishna consciousness. He was getting PhDs, doctors, psychologists, professors. They were chanting 16 rounds. They were following the regulative principles. They were scrutinizingly studying Prabhupada's books. They were sold out to the mission of ISKCON. They took initiation. The most qualified devotees in all of America, most all of them, were becoming Krishna conscious by the incredible efforts of Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. Now, some of the things he's done has been criticized and controversial. But I can tell you, from my deep conviction, whoever criticizes simply does not understand the compassion and broad-mindedness of this personality. When I was at Gita Nagari, I was seeing qualified, intelligent people that came from those innovative, creative, indirect preaching programs. They would have never, ever, ever associated with devotees any other way, and now they are full-fledged, perfectly cultured, wonderful Gaudiya Vaishnavas. You could judge a thing by its result. You can judge a tree by its fruit. It was his deep compassion to reach people's hearts that he approached people in such incredibly genius ways in the Western world and brought them to the lotus feet of Srila Prabhupada and Gaur Nitai, where they surrendered. Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj Ki Jai. Meanwhile, we are still meeting every year, several times. And we'd sit at the table and eat, and we'd lay on the floor and we'd walk and we'd talk, and we'd sit and we'd talk, but we talked. Because whatever was building up in my heart, I had to save for Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj. And same for him. It was a beautiful relationship. And one of the things, every time we met, one of the things we always discussed for at least a half hour was the amazing grace that we both had that we never got malaria. Because in India, so many people get malaria. And in Africa, so many people get malaria. And he would always say, I've been in Africa for so many years, every devotee gets malaria, I never got malaria. And I said, I've been in India so many years, so many devotees get malaria, I never got malaria. So that, we always discussed. For about 8 years, we discussed this malaria subject. And I can tell you that both of us were developing some pride. There was a certain pride of never getting malaria. Because what else can someone like me get proud of? Anyways, 1 year, I got malaria. Dwarkadish Prabhu, Dr. Alua can tell you all about it. It was so severe. I had fever and I was sweating and they gave me medicine, and every time they gave me medicine I would vomit it up. They brought me to hospital before there was a Bhaktivedanta, some other hospital. And they had to give me intravenous injections to try to somehow or other relieve this malaria. And the whole time I was there I was thinking, how am I going to explain this to Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj? I'm a traitor. To my great surprise, the next time we met, he told me, Maharaj, I have a confession to make. I said, what? He said, I got malaria. We exchanged notes, and it turned out we both came down with the fever at the same day, at the same time. And we were both admitted to hospital on the same day, at the same time, in the same year. He was in Africa, I was in India. And we were probably bitten by mosquitoes at the same time, too. But we were both rejoicing. Just see our connection.